Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Mike Zweibel. I represent Mike Ardia, the defendant in this case. We raised four issues in this appeal. What I'd like to focus on, what I'd like to address, is the issue that appeared second in the briefs regarding the exclusion of the testimony of Dr. Terry Finney. Dr. Finney's testimony was offered to describe the risk factors for sexual offending, five risk factors, and also to offer her opinion that based on her testing of the defendant using the same psychological instruments used by the Sex Offender Management Board, that the defendant did not display any of those risk factors. This evidence was excluded erroneously under Rule 702. It was relevant, it was reliable, and therefore it was admissible under what are called the liberal standards for admissibility of that rule. The evidence was relevant, first of all, because it tended to make a material fact less probable. The material fact, of course, was whether the defendant committed the offense, which has been identified as a material fact in cases like Rath that I cited in the brief. The absence of the risk factors makes that material fact, the defendant committed the offense, less probable. And Dr. Finney testified that that is to a reasonable degree of psychological certainty. This evidence is the same kind of framework or syndrome evidence that is routinely held admissible when offered by the prosecution to demonstrate patterns of behavior and characteristics consistent with guilt. And I think a really good example of that is the Masters case. In Masters, Dr. Malloy was permitted to testify, and the Supreme Court held it was proper that he testify that sexual offenders, people who commit sexual homicides, tend to harbor rehearsal fantasies. And then based on the defendant's drawings, he was able to identify defendant's rehearsal fantasies for the sexual homicide, thereby showing that he possessed a characteristic harboring rehearsal fantasies that was consistent with the commission of a sexual homicide. There's, of course, other examples. The gay case regarding characteristics of drug runners, Richardson case regarding the methodology of stalkers. All of these approve the admission of evidence that is intended to demonstrate the likelihood that defendant committed the offense by showing that the defendant displays characteristics common to offenders and consistent with the offense.
Let me ask you this. Could the defendant have called a close friend to testify about his reputation for good character and express an opinion that he was not a violent person?
Yes.
Or did not show any unusual sexual proclivities?
I think he could have.
So why can't the expert? And that's, of course, is your argument.
And that's my argument. You know, and I think the court, I think Your Honor has hit upon one of the interesting aspects of this. There's really two bases, I think, for the admission of this expert testimony. One is that it is the same kind of framework or syndrome evidence that's normally admitted. Dr. Finney's testimony concerned a pattern of behavior, history of sexual offending, history of childhood behavior problems, history of deviant behavior. And it was just offered to demonstrate the converse of what Masters say, for example, was offered to demonstrate in this case that it was inconsistent with commission of the offense. But the other basis for admission, I think, is Rule 404A, which is a defendant offering a pertinent trait of character to show that it was not likely that he committed the offense.
And all that goes to relevance, doesn't it?
It does.
Okay, so on the reliability prong of what the trial court is supposed to do, is that determination an issue of law that we review de novo, or is it a factual determination to which we have to give deference to the trial court if there's support in the record?
Well, first of all, I would argue that this is a constitutional violation, that this was like in Golub, this was testimony that went to defendant's right to present a defense. And what they said in Golub, and it's difficult exactly to discern what the standard of review is. What they say is, first of all, normally expert testimony is reviewed for abuse of discretion. However, when it trespasses upon defendant's constitutional right, we have to view it under the constitutional harmless error standard.
That doesn't solve the problem of whether there's error in the first place.
Right, and it seems that there's a step missing. But in that case, the court seemed to be saying that if the expert, if you looked at the kind of testimony that was excluded there, what they seemed to be saying is that if the testimony is important to the defense, if it supports the defendant's defense, then it is error. That is constitutional error. And so they seem to be implying a de novo standard of review, being the determination that this is, whether or not this is the kind of evidence that is crucial or important to the defendant's defense. But I agree that was left unspoken. In the Golub case, and that
and it also phrased that way takes you right back into the relevancy determination more than the reliability determination.
It does, you know, and let me say this about the reliability determination too, is that the court here did abuse its discretion, even if it is an abuse of discretion standard, because it employed the wrong legal standard. And that is automatically an abuse of discretion. I mean, when that happens, this court gets to re-examine the evidence under the correct legal standard. And so, in a sense, I don't even know that we need to get there. We can say the court abused its discretion because it employed an incorrect legal standard. Whether or not the court employed a correct legal standard in making the determination is a de novo question of law. And also, by definition, an abuse of discretion. And I think that's what happened here. So I don't think we need to decide here generally whether reliability, because I have to say Golub is less than clear on that. But I think that we don't need to decide whether, in general, the reliability determination is de novo or an abuse of discretion, because here the court employed an incorrect legal standard, which automatically brings us to a de novo.
I think my colleague wants to know the relevance.
I'm sorry. What's the relevance of the evidence? Evidence is relevant because the absence of the risk factors makes it less likely that the defendant committed the offense. It demonstrates that the defendant.
Well, has the science that the expert relied upon, does it say that, or does it say that if you are a convicted sex offender and if you have these traits, you're more likely to repeat?
That's not what Dr. Finney testified to. Dr. Finney testified that in the field of psychology, that for at least 15 years, it has been accepted in the literature, in the peer-reviewed literature, that these are risk factors for sexual offending. Now, I know the prosecution has argued that because these factors were drawn from convicted sex offenders, that's the only population you can apply them to. That argument, I think, would mean that very little psychological expert testimony could be admitted in these kinds of cases. For example, in Masters, how do they determine what a characteristics are for sexual homicides? You have to look at people who are known to have committed sexual homicides and then work backwards to apply them as risk factors or predictive factors to other people. The same thing, I think, applies to characteristics of victims of sexual assault. Look at child abuse accommodation syndrome or other behavioral syndromes that are applied to victims of sexual assault. You have to start with a pool of known victims. These are people who we know have been victimized. What characteristics do they display? And then you testify about whether or not behaviors that are exhibited by a person at the trial stage when it is still merely an allegation are consistent with these. And so I think that argument would really pretty much invalidate any kind of psychological expert testimony, because you have to start with a pool of known offenders or known victims in order to determine what the characteristics are.
Here's why, Bill. Cited a couple of cases in your brief, Stoll from California, and also one of the cases from Wisconsin.
Davis.
There are other cases from Wisconsin, but I'm sure you're aware the vast majority of jurisdictions have held to the contrary of those cases and have refused to allow this very kind of testimony.
Judge, I'm sorry.
In looking at Davis, the Davis court expressly said that reliability is a question of fact for the jury in Wisconsin, and that's just not the case here. So they don't even get to the question of reliability in Wisconsin. And Stahl is based upon they have a statute in California that allows the kind of evidence. So it seems to me those cases really don't have much applicability here. And in the decisions on this issue where we don't have those circumstances, the courts are just unanimously against your position.
Well, first of all, I know there are some, but I don't know that it's overwhelming and that it's unanimous. But I would say that the Davis case, first of all, I cited that case not on the reliability prong, but on the relevance prong. That's where it was argued. The reliability is a different argument. This testimony clearly is reliable.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, though. The trial court here found that it wasn't.
By the wrong standard.
Well, it found that it wasn't, okay? And in Colorado, we allow trial courts to make that determination. We don't leave that to the jury like they do in Wisconsin. Okay. And it seems to me that even if the trial court arguably applied the wrong standard, if it considered all the correct facts and reached that conclusion, the correct conclusion, why don't we affirm on that basis?
If this court concludes that this testimony is unreliable by applying the correct legal standard, then obviously that's the conclusion you're going to reach. But I think that would be contrary to the case law regarding psychological testimony. See, one of the things I'm getting at here is that when psychological testimony is offered by the prosecution, it's okay that it's inexact science. It's okay that it's not predictive. It's okay that there's no exclusive cause and effect relationship. It's okay that it's based entirely on clinical impressions. It's okay that it ties defendants' characteristics or character to the characteristics of a group of offenders. But when the defense offers exactly similar testimony, I think those are the same standards that ought to be applied. I don't think we need to go out of state to get to that conclusion, because the courts have said, Masters said, it's an inexact science. You can't ask for error rates. You can't ask for control group testing. Child abuse accommodation syndrome is a syndrome that's based entirely on clinical impressions, and it's routinely admitted. Stevens says you don't need to show an exact cause and effect relationship between the behaviors and the conclusion or the offense.
I think, though, that the trial court's concern was that the study groups involved here weren't analogous to the defendant here. I mean, there was some kind of a disconnect there between how the data was arrived at and how that might apply to the defendant. There was that disconnect.
Is the court talking about the fact that this was a group of convicted sex offenders? Well,
yes.
I think I've addressed that. I mean, I don't see how you can determine what the risk factors are for sexual offending, unless you know you're looking at sexual offenders, just as how can you determine what are the behaviors of sex assault victims, unless you already have proven in some fashion that they've been victimized. I think it's always a process of working backwards. And this really, I think, is in that sense, is no different than the testimony in Masters, the testimony in Stevens, the testimony about child abuse accommodation syndrome. It's the same kind of process of identifying these characteristics or factors. I'd like to reserve my last minute, if that's okay. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Ryan Crane, and I represent the people in this case. My attorney registration number is 37842. The correct standard of review here is abuse of discretion because this was an admission of evidence question. The trial court did not apply the wrong standard because what it was looking at was applying Rule 702, which is our rule of evidence regarding expert testimony, and it applied Schreck, the case that interprets Rule 702. As the defendant has noted, and we agree on this, Schreck focuses on reliability and relevance, and as the court has pointed out, the trial court's finding here was based primarily on reliability, not on relevance. The defendant's argument with respect to character evidence and with respect to comparing the evidence here to these other cases, Masters and so forth, is a relevance argument. The problem here was the trial court made a pretty insightful ruling, actually, pointing out after the prosecutor did some initial cross-examination of this expert, the trial court followed up with a few questions of its own and determined, I'll quote from the transcript, that the conclusion the court draws is there is no recognized scientific standard or testing to determine if an individual is a sex offender. That was important here because the expert, despite what defense counsel initially elicited through his questioning at trial, it became clear after the cross-examination and the trial court's own questions that the data that this expert was relying on or speaking of had shown, it showed that these characteristics that everyone was talking about, these five factors, have been shown and agreed upon by experts for 15 years, that these factors or personality characteristics correlate with a risk in convicted sex offenders to recidivate. That's what these factors mean. They have no correlation, no tested or accepted correlation with determining whether or not members of the general population have committed a sex offense in the past. And so it's kind of a fine distinction in a way, but
it's also an impossible burden. I mean, that would, the mirror image, mm-hmm. as a practical matter, can't be done.
Well, if we could find out whether or not members of the general population have committed a sex offense, if we could do some sort of
then they'd be a known sex offender, and the same, I mean, we'd be running the test for recidivism.
Well, if there was some sort of, confidential exam or something where people would admit to having committed
a sex offense. What you'd have to do is find a population of sufficient size who had not committed a sex offense to your knowledge, mm-hmm. okay? And then run these risk factors and determine whether they have them or not, and then wait 20 years to see if any of them offend.
Well, or you could ask them have they committed a sex offense in the past. I mean,
well, I know, but we'll have to assume they said no, because you're trying to. This evidence here is being used to predict whether someone who has not previously offended to our knowledge actually offended.
Right.
That's what it's offered for.
Correct.
It seems to me difficult for your office to make the arguments you're making after urging that Masters was appropriate evidence.
Well, Masters is distinguishable.
Masters is distinguishable on a lot of grounds, but that expert had never seen Mr. Masters, mm-hmm. didn't know anything about Mr. Masters except what perhaps he was informed of by the authorities, and formed an opinion about Mr. Masters, and that is that people who do this are more likely to do that. Well, and he had admittedly made drawings that right. were maybe disgusting in many people's eyes, but he was predicting. He was making a prediction that Mr. Masters could commit or would commit this crime. I'm not sure exactly what the testimony was, but it was proclivity evidence.
I disagree a little bit. I think what Masters involved was an expert's opinion that when you have people who have been convicted of committing sexual homicides, it has been shown to be common that they have done these rehearsal fantasies. And so here Masters had done those rehearsal fantasies, it would make sense that he also did these other things. By contrast, these factors, as I understand them, as I think the record shows, they show that people that we know are convicted sex offenders are likely to commit another sex offense, okay? So they've already...
You just said the Masters evidence was based upon known sex offenders.
This evidence was based on people that have already committed a sex offense and whether or not they're likely during their treatment, et cetera, to recidivate. And so that's distinguishable from Masters, whereas in Masters you knew that this event had happened And in these in this, the evidence that was presented here was showing a correlation with recidivism among convicted offenders. I think that's distinguishable. And in any case, regardless of what Baster said, the trial court was 100% correct in this case, finding that this evidence has zero accepted or shown correlation, statistical or otherwise, for the meaning that defense counsel wants to.
You're saying that's required for psychological testimony?
I'm saying the trial court didn't abuse its discretion in this case, and the trial court was correct in saying that there's no accepted, well, as the court is aware, the various factors such as general acceptance and statistical correlation, those are all factors that can be considered. The trial court considered those factors and in this case found that, considering all of those factors, this shouldn't be admitted in this case.
What do you look at to determine general acceptance?
Well, I mean, that's been discussed in Fry and some other cases. I honestly didn't look into it in depth. I think you look at the other experts in the field and peer-reviewed journals, and the record here showed that this use of the testimony, the testimony that defense counsel wanted to present this testimony for, had no accepted value for this purpose. No one uses it for this purpose. It wasn't developed for this purpose. It isn't accepted for this purpose. Certainly had no statistical evidence supporting its use for this purpose. And so that's why the trial court was certainly within its discretion. I think it was correct, in fact, to say this is going to be of zero use to the jury, and this is not reliable at all for this purpose. And for that reason, it's also irrelevant in this case, and the expert is not qualified to give this opinion, because the things she's talking about have to do with not this application of these studies that she's...
So what you're saying is that the factors that are used in evaluating convicted sex offenders,
yes,
to determine recidivism, are of no value in predicting whether someone who has not been convicted of a sex offense, mm-hmm, will commit a sex offense.
Or whether they committed a sex offense in the past.
I'm saying you can't use the same factors that you used to predict a known sex offender, mm-hmm, to recidivate. That does not bear any correlation to finding the presence or absence of those factors in the general population and predicting whether someone without those factors will offend, or someone with those factors will offend.
I don't know that there's any correlation, and that's the problem, is that there is, okay, no tested correlation.
There's a logical one, but maybe not a scientific one.
Yeah, and it's speculative probably for me to say, I think there probably is or there probably isn't, and that's what defense counsel was asking the trial court and ultimately the jury to do, and he was kind of asking his expert to do that, I think. If there's no further questions on that point, I want to respond to one or two points in the reply brief with respect to the argument that it was the defendant's fourth argument, arguing that the victim's prior consistent statements were improperly introduced. I specifically want to respond to a statement in the reply brief on page 16, which said that the victim was impeached only with respect to her trial testimony, and therefore there was no basis on which to introduce prior consistent statements prior to trial that she had made. That is incorrect. The victim was impeached with respect to at least five statements she had made prior to trial, alleging that or implying that her testimony at trial was inconsistent with those statements, or at least that it had been inconsistent over time. Specifically, the victim was cross-examined about her interview with a police detective, Danny, of which her statements were introduced at trial, about her dream with regards to the defendant's abuse against her. That dream was never discussed on direct examination with her. With regards to the letter that she wrote to her mother describing the abuses, with respect to her trial preparation with the district attorneys prior to trial, that was on page 107 of the transcript of July 28th. And with respect to whether or not the victim had grabbed her, that was also in her interview with Detective Danny prior to trial. So there were at least four or five different instances of prior statements she had made with respect to which defense counsel cross-examined her during trial. So it's incorrect to say that she was only impeached with respect to her trial testimony and that therefore her prior consistent statements prior to trial were irrelevant to show her consistency. I'll also respond briefly to page 15 of the reply brief, wherein it was alleged that a hearsay objection with relation to the victim's statements to her mother, I argued, was not preserved. And the defense counsel quoted objection hearsay. My argument is that is not preserved, and that objection actually was not lodged after the relevant statements were made. And I'm referring to page 15 of the reply brief, and it's pages 150 to 52 of the transcript of July 28th, 2009. If the court has no further questions, I'll be happy to sit down. I
thank you, sir,
for his time and ask that the decision be affirmed.
Four out of the five statements were from her prior testimony. I didn't say trial testimony. It was prior testimony. I just looked to make sure that that's what I said, and I did. It was from the preliminary hearing. So that's what that was a reference to. Mr. Crane has said that its defense counsel wants to make risk factors that were drawn from convicted offenders relevant to non-convicted offenders. But it's not defense counsel, it's Dr. Finney. Dr. Finney said, in the field, it is accepted that these are risk factors for predicting sexual offending. And she said that a number of times. She didn't limit the opinion to convicted sex offenders. And that was, in fact, never contradicted. And so I think that her testimony was, not defense counsel's argument, but her testimony was that it's relevant for that purpose. And finally, the test need not show whether somebody will commit a sex offense. It simply needs to make it more or less, tend to make it more or less probable that a sex offense has been committed. It doesn't have to show an exact cause and effect relationship, as I think the Stevens case makes clear.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your briefs and arguments. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. This completes our